Welcome to Frankly Speaking, where we aim to solve any business owner problem, anywhere, anytime, hopefully before it happens here. I'm Alan Franks, and today we're going to get real about something most owners don't think about until it's too late, selling a business. A lot of companies are profitable, but not sellable. And when a deal gets chipped away at the last minute, usually it's not because the owner didn't work hard, it's because the business wasn't investor ready. My guest today, Bennett Leibowitz, president of Pando Consulting Group. Bennett helps owners turn almost sellable companies into businesses that can actually close, using financial and operational pre-diligence to surface the issues that kill deals before the buyer finds them. Bennett, welcome. Thank you so much for coming. I want to start where the audience is. Building a company that runs well today and holds up under buyer scrutiny tomorrow. But Bennett, before we hop in, tell us a little bit about your journey and how you got to helping businesses sell.
Yeah, Alan, it's great to see you, man. Thanks for having me on. I'm really excited for our conversation today. Yeah, I think, as you can see, I got a black sheep behind me, and I think that tells a lot about my spirit animal. I don't do things conventionally, and my path to this has been very unconventional. I started out actually as a chef, which I was cooking in the industry for about 17 years. My family is really probably four generations deep of being entrepreneurs. So I always had that entrepreneurial kind of bug in my blood and always had a passion around it. It just kind of happened to be around the hospitality industry initially. And after 100-hour weeks and about to have our second child, I decided that I would go back into finance, which is where I was in college, and started working at Northwestern Mutual as a financial planner. And then moved over to another agency where I was able to really do fee-based planning for business owners and really found a passion around helping them get ready to sell their companies and realized how much they really needed that support system. They really were on an island by themselves. They didn't really have any really outside advice. Everything was pretty subjective. And so really being able to have the sounding board of ideas and really what their concerns were, I found a true passion around helping them through that process. Pando came out of really a necessity to focus in on really what the clients were asking me to do, which was a much deeper analysis of their company and really helping defend them once they were ready to go to market.
And just to clarify for the audience, you no longer have your securities license anymore, right? You're not doing any sort of financial advising. You decided, hey, you know what? I want to dedicate 100% of my time to this pre-diligence helping business owners sell, correct?
Yeah, there was, I loved my time doing that space, but there were just some regulations that I had to kind of circumnavigate to really do the work that my clients wanted me to do. And so I felt like, it was best to go ahead and really be able to put 100% of my time and energy into this. And it's been an incredible journey so far.
Awesome. Well, and I just want to applaud you for making that leap and starting your own business. I think it goes so far when we're talking to other business owners to say, hey, this person took the same leap of faith that you did. They put in the same hours, the emotional turmoil, the mental turmoil that you did, Mr. and Mrs. Business Owner. So I just want to applaud you for making that leap. I'm certain it has not been easy, but I'm certain it's been fulfilling.
Yeah, we also, we had an 80-year-old legacy company, third generation, that we sold last year. So I've seen all sides of it. I mean, this is not just from working on our side of the table. We have actually taken a lot of what we do, applied it to our family business, and was able to create a successful exit last June.
Congratulations. Yeah, that's fair. Hey, when it comes to selling a business, obviously, we've heard of Murphy's Law. Anything that can go wrong will go wrong. I want to throw in Sod's Law on there, which is an English more, even a more negative tone on it because it's British, right? It says anything that will go wrong, can go wrong, will go wrong at the worst possible time. And that's how I feel about when when businesses are being sold, right? So, hey, let's do this. Let's hop on in and let's talk about when you first meet an owner. What is the quickest signal that you're looking for that tells you whether this business could be sold or whether this could be really messy?
Oh God, it would probably be if I'm in their office and they have a revolving door of employees coming in for them mm-hmm. to solve problems. And mm-hmm. I see that all the time. Time and time again, there are very few systems and processes put into place to actually solve problems. So it becomes this kind of recurring event, and it's just a very reactive state.
Yep.
We say that, you know, for an owner, their true position should really be a strategic position, because nobody else is going to do that in the business, yep, right? And so they really need to be able to hire around areas that are, they're not as proficient around, and really leverage somebody else's skill set to be able to really take hold of where the company is trying to go in the day-to-day side, the tactical side, so that the owner can really focus on the strategic side of the business.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I heard somebody talk one time, and they're talking about the survival state and the creative state. And it's, yep, really hard. And what you just talked about was somebody in a survival state, fires coming in all the time. Only they can put it out, or at least somebody else can put it out, but they got to get a stamp of approval to put it out. And you're right, that's a telltale sign that this is too owner dependent to maybe go to market right now. Hey, well, so you're known for turning almost sellable businesses into investor ready. What's usually missing in that gap?
You know, financial reporting is a big one. You know, obviously the finance side is where a lot of the value is coming from, but that's really only on the valuation side. You have to understand that a buyer is not only buying your business for what you're telling them it's creating from a cash flow perspective, but once they buy you out of the business, the operations need to really be self-sufficient. And so it goes back to your original question. You know, it operationally is where we see some of the biggest opportunities for a company to really get exit ready, to have all their processes and systems documented, to have everything from a governance standpoint buttoned up, to make sure that they're looking at any kind of liability risk, looking at contracts to see if they're transferable, really just understanding that when they hand this business over to a buyer, that the buyer's going to feel comfortable in running the business the day after you walk away. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times you can make, you know, like the financial side of things, the reporting, you can hire somebody to go back and reconcile and clean up the books. Operationally, it takes a lot more time to be able to do that. And so timing is really critical into the success of what you're trying to accomplish through the sale. If it's a turnaround project, you can't do that in less than 12 months. You really need to be able to have a 3 to 5 year runway to really be able to reduce the owner reliance, but also be able to say, here's a well-oiled process and operations that you, new buyer, can come in tomorrow and ensure that the growth that we're saying is on the table of what we're promising to you is doable, that you're going to be able to run this company just like I was for the last 15, 20 years, and you're going to be able to grow this company to the next level. We've built the infrastructure.
And really, Bennett, that's just running a good company. That's just running a good business. Like, even if you don't sell, that's really important to not have people coming into your office every 15 seconds to ask for permission to put out a fire, right? And what's interesting, what you said is, yeah, the financial clarity piece, we can kind of outsource that. We can go get a CPA to go clean up our books, move us from cash to accrual, things of that nature. But we can't fake operational discipline and leadership dependency, right? We can't just, we have systems and operations. That takes hard work. That takes time.
Yeah, I mean, look, nothing we are going to do in our process is harmful to the company. We're reducing risk. We're improving scalability and support of the growth that you're trying to achieve in your business, the efficiency, the ability to hire people that you're leveraging their skill set so that you can focus on your skill set. Business owners didn't get into business to run a business. They got into business because they had a passion or a skill set around something that they knew they could sell to the public, right? And so they just wake up one day and they just realize, like, okay, I'm not even doing that anymore. I'm doing the books. I'm answering calls. I'm scheduling. I'm doing all these. I'm doing sales and marketing. I'm doing all these things, but they weren't originally my skill set. And so I don't even have the time or bandwidth to be able to do the things that I love and why I started this business. And we just want to get them back to that natural state of theirs.
Yep.
So that when they decide they're ready to go to market, that shows, right, that they built a company that is leveraging their ability to grow it versus the day-to-day tactical side of the business.
Yep. Great. And so when you're working with a business, they get an LOI, then the buyer goes in, they're doing their due diligence, and they're trying to just chip away at that price here. What are some more common deal killers that buyers can use to kind of grind the owner down over time and get that valuation a little bit lower?
Governance is a big one. Going in and asking them around financial data points is a huge issue because most businesses are very reactive in how they are running their books. They don't have forecasting or budgeting. They have a anomalous growth that they want to hit this year, but they don't have any data to actually back that up or historical figures to say, this is where we've been and this is where we're going. So, you know, the idea around due diligence is they want to uncover as much risk as they can during that process. And if you don't have an answer to come back with their questions, then they start digging deeper and deeper. And so, you know, what we see is, what's your process around A, B, or C? Well, we do it this way. We do it great. Is it documented? No, it's not documented, but everybody knows how to do that. Well, how do you know that? You know, and what issues come up? Well, we have this, this, and this. Do you have documented processes around that so it doesn't happen again? No, but, you know, we're working on it, right? And so it's always very kind of sleight of hand in terms of what the owner is trying to convey to the buyer. Mm-hmm. And what we want to be able to do is we want to be able to control the narrative. So when we go into a due diligence process, really even LOI based timeline, we want them to have a quality of earnings that we've run on them. We want them to have all of their systems documented. We want to have the data room built out and making sure that all the documents that are in there are clean documents. And so when they ask for something, it is readily available and you cut that timeline down. What happens is when they start asking questions and they're not getting answers that they're expecting, it causes concern for them. And that's their process, right? I mean, it's not necessarily to chip away. It's that sellers are not typically prepared for that process and they're running their business day to day while they're going through that. So it's an incredibly emotionally taxing time period for them. And so it doesn't take a whole lot to break the owner's back in terms of just, you know, constantly dealing with questions from the buyer's group and trying to provide responses that are not going to put them in a bad light. We just want to be able to do all that heavy lifting before that ever happens.
Totally. So let's talk about that mind shift change. Sure. You know, a lot of business owners, they may not say this, but they probably feel like they own a job here, or, you know, maybe it's an ATM machine for them that they live their life out of, but very few of them feel like they own an asset, right? How do you help that business owner go from seeing their business as a cash ATM that they live their life by to an asset that we need to improve on and sell?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one thing we have to state is that our ideal client is a very strategic minded client. If we're coming in and they are living out of the business, they have every personal expense put through the business, it's not clearly identified on their books, they're doing it to reduce tax obligations. These are things that are really, really difficult to unwind, right? Because you have years and years of this habit. Yeah. And to pull them out and pay them a salary and have them live off of that salary while still showing cash flow and profit in the company, if there's a magic sauce to that, I don't have it yet. Yeah. Because they've become accustomed to living a lifestyle that the business has been able to provide. But that's not always a pathway to showing a business of value, right? Yeah. And in order to do that, you really have to scale it all the way back and almost rebuild it from the ground up, because every system in the business has been built to provide income and lifestyle income for the owner without necessarily showing value on the books. And that's hard to unwind.
Coming up next, I'm going to get tactical with Bennett on pre-diligence, what it is, what it isn't, and the specific tests that keep buyers from discounting you at the 11th hour. I'm Alan Franks, host of Frankly Speaking, only on Now Media Television. We're here with one goal and one goal only. Our aim is to solve any business owner problem, anywhere, anytime. Join me for my next episode of Frankly Speaking, only on Now Media Television. Stay connected to this show and every Now Media TV favorite, live, on demand, anytime you like. Download the free Now Media TV app on Roku or iOS and unlock nonstop bilingual programming in English and Spanish. If you're on the move, catch the podcast version at nowmedia.tv. Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm here with Bennett Leibowitz of Pando Consulting Group. Now we're getting into the part owners think they'll handle later on, until a buyer starts asking questions that can't be answered cleanly. Pre-diligence is how you find your own leaks before someone else uses them against you. So Bennett, if you could please help us here, define pre-diligence the way you explain it to an owner who's never sold a business before. What are we doing before the buyer's team ever shows up?
Yeah, I mean, I think the easiest analogy is selling a house. Most business owners have never sold a business, but they've sold a house before. And so think of it as that pre-inspection that a realtor brings in somebody to kind of look at the house, understand where the faults are, maybe also have some recommendations that can improve the value. You know, it's like, hey, you may want to update your bathroom. You may want to put a new coat of paint on the walls, get some new carpet, whatever, cosmetic, or even infrastructure-based fixes that are going to improve the value of your house. We're very similar. What we're doing is we're going in and we're pressure testing your company through the eyes of a buyer. So the idea is for us to find everything that we can possibly find within your business from a financial and operational standpoint. And now really we're looking at technology because AI is such a critical play and the success and failure of businesses now as they're going to market. We're starting to look at tech stack. We're looking at where your data is being warehoused, how it's communicating with each other. So we really want to do a deep dive within your business so that we can find all of those ugly truths that everybody has that nobody wants to talk about and you probably haven't talked about for years, but they're building up and festering and causing big problems when you are actually looking to sell your company. And so we just want to be able to identify that early on. And so we kind of walk you through a 90-day process where we assess your company, come back with the findings and saying, hey, this is where we think next steps would really kind of show value in your company based on the timeline you're telling us that you want to sell. So you want 12 months or less, then there's not a whole lot we can do. You got 3 to 5 years, there's a lot that we can do. And we leverage our strategic partners to be able to do that for us.
Great. And part of this is something called a quality of earnings report. If you're a business owner, let's assume somebody's listening today that's never heard of, or they've heard of it, but they don't really know what it is. Can you help us understand what a quality of earnings report is and how that can affect and oftentimes distort the EBITDA?
Yeah, so every buyer is going to do a quality of earnings, right? The problem is that sellers have never done a quality earnings unless they've been audited by the IRS. To really be able to understand what is taking place in their accounting. And so really it's kind of a high level term, but really what we're doing is we're making sure the chart of accounts and general ledger match so that when it ends up on your P&L and balance sheet, everything is accurate and tied into that chart of accounts. So it's checks and balances that when you're showing a P&L or balance sheet to a buyer, that they know that that information is accurate and that they don't have to go in and really do a lot of digging into what's taking place. The problem is it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, is that when you are living in your company and you're putting a lot of your personal expenses, meals with clients, advertising and marketing, traveling, all of these things kind of fit in there, that general ledger shows that, right? Every transaction that's taking place, but it's being miscategorized. And so a buyer's going to come in and they're going to find it, right? And so our whole process is, once again, is to be able to walk you through that beforehand so we can fix it, clean it up, and so that when you go to a buyer, your books are sparkling clean and you can't wait to show them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fantastic. So we talked about quality of earnings. Let's talk about quality of operations here. What are the operational gaps that really scare buyers, even when the finances look good?
Yeah, I mean, employee risk is a big one. We're dealing with one right now where we have two key employees that are generating 3/4 of the income or revenue that's coming into the business. One is a very type A personality, lone wolf kind of salesperson that really does not want to transfer their ability to have somebody come in and work underneath them. And so we have to work around these things and understanding where are the biggest gaps in your HR, and do you have the right people on the bus, and are they in the right seats? A lot of times you bring people in because you need to hire somebody to take on something, and then they come in that role, and then as time goes on, you keep putting things on them that are not necessarily their skill set. They're maybe getting the job done, maybe not. But it's not an efficient way to run your business. And so we'll actually go in and run an audit of your HR and really understand from a department-based standpoint, do we have the right people in there? And if not, where are some of the redundancies and gaps that exist so that we can put the right people in those places and maybe move somebody into a better seat? Because once again, a buyer's coming in and it's like a marriage, right? They're coming into your business and they are acquiring your company and they're trying to fold it in into either theirs, or they're going to have to manage it as a standalone. And that's a daunting task when you're trying to figure out, do you have the right people in the right places that are going to help you achieve your ROI?
Yep. Great insight there. Now let's talk about some issues that really kill deals before buyers can even negotiate. What's the most common surprise that triggers retrading late in the process?
Cold feet.
On which end, buyer or seller?
Seller, typically.
Really?
And I'll be honest, my dad, he almost sunk the deal twice in the last 2 weeks of it. At 85 years old, he was like, I'm not ready to quit. And he just, you know, did not see how he was going to fill that time once he was done. And so it's something that... Two things either happen. One, the due diligence process is so crazy that they wear the seller down and they're just selling at a discount to get it done.
Yep.
Or they feel like they're leaving money on the table and they get cold feet and they decide to walk. And either way, these are very dangerous things because no one's talking to the shareholder through this process. Once again, a lot of sellers don't have an advisory team that's helping them through this process. Mm-hmm. They may have a banker, they may have a broker, but these are people to help facilitate the deal. They're not going in and checking the status of the headspace of the owner. And so we talk and work a lot with financial planners because we see them on the personal side. We are solely focused on the business. We are solely focused on that pre-sale engagement to get them in that position to always be transaction ready. But then there's this whole other side of it. It's like, well, you've been working 50, 60 hours a week. What are you going to do to fill that time once you walk away?
Yeah.
What passions do you have? How do you feel about selling this? Like all of these things, these are very important conversations. You know, Alan, I know you know the stat, but like 75% of sellers that regret their decision to sell within the first 12 months.
Yeah.
Staggering. So you're telling me 25% are excited about this.
Yeah.
That's not great news for a seller, right? And so something has to be done. Somebody has to have these conversations. And that's where we work with a lot of wealth managers and financial planners to be able to have that conversation.
I tell you, Bennett, if you think about it, only about 25 businesses at list ever get sold. And then about 25% of the ones that sell are happy with it. Means the actual success rate is less than 5%. And so if you're a business owner and you think that you could do this on your own without people like Bennett in your life, feel free to try here. But this is hard. This is not selling a house, right? This is selling a business. It is a challenge, and having your deal team, like people with Bennett on there, super critical. So speaking of which, Bennett, for owners here that want a readiness baseline, let's call it, where can they connect with you? How can they reach out to you?
Yeah, so our website is, it's a long one, Pando, P-A-N-D-O, consultinggroup.com. And we have a, you can just send us a message internally, and we'd be more than happy to respond to that. You can also find me on LinkedIn. And so, yeah, we're wanting to have conversations to be able to help educate owners around the realities of going to market. It doesn't matter your revenue size. It doesn't matter your timeline. We just want to have a conversation so that you have insight into what this is actually going to look like. And then it's fully up to you on whether you decide to do something about it, right? We're not here to talk anybody into anything, but we do highly regard education as kind of the platform that we communicate through. And I think it's incredibly important for every business owner out there to understand that this is not something that you can just kind of throw your business out on the open market and buyers are going to come in droves to acquire you. And talk to some friends of yours, but the reality is not that. And you just listed all those stats, Alan. I mean, it's 5% that are actually selling it are happy about the sale. To me, that would be a big wake-up call.
Yep. Well, up next, I want to connect pre-diligence to something viewers care about just as much as valuation, taxes, because a great sale price can still become a disappointing outcome if the exit isn't planned tax smartly. We'll be back with Bennett Leibowitz. I'm Alan Franks, host of Frankly Speaking, only on Now Media Television. We're here with one goal and one goal only. Our aim is to solve any business owner problem, anywhere, anytime. Join me for my next episode of Frankly Speaking, only on Now Media Television. Welcome back. We've covered what buyers look for and how pre-diligence protects valuations. Now I want to talk about the silent wealth killer, taxes and the deal structure, because I've seen owners celebrate a headline number and then feel sick to their stomachs when they see what actually hits their account. So Bennett, when you're working with an owner preparing them and preparing a company for sale, what's the earliest point that tax strategy should enter the conversation?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's so many nuances that go into that, Alan. I mean, are you an asset sale? Are you a stock sale? You know, a lot of these questions, this is why we work so closely with CPAs and making sure that they understand exactly what it is that the owner is trying to accomplish through the sale so that they can start giving some advice on the structure around it. And, you know, the idea is that I would say 6 months before really going to market, as we're developing the SIM and really coming in and helping them understand their timeline, that's where we're bringing in all the advisors that we're talking to. So attorneys, CPAs, wealth managers, estate planners, I mean, whoever it is that we need to bring in, it's really important to have that kind of window of opportunity. It doesn't mean that if we have a year out, that we're not having that conversation and saying, okay, based on what the laws are and maybe some of the opportunities that exist, what do we need to do around those things so that we can set ourselves up appropriately? You know, the type of entity you are you C Corp, S Corp, you know, what are the things that are going to play into that during the sale? All of these things need to come up. And that's why we leverage our partnerships, because we have to have experts in those areas to really be able to get to the details of what we're trying to accomplish.
And for most business owners, they just think they're selling a company. They've never even heard of the idea of an asset sale versus a stock sale. Can you walk us through the differences between an asset sale and a stock sale?
Sure. I mean, so, you know, assets are physical, tangible items that you have on your books. Let's think about like an HVAC company that has, you know, a fleet of 30 vehicles, and they maybe even have a building that they're operating out of. They have inventory they have on hand. So that would be, when you're selling those, that's what you're selling, is the asset. The benefit is that it's really more to the buyer, because they are not mm-hmm. taking on any liability mm-hmm. through an asset purchase. But it's usually not as advantageous to a seller to do an asset purchase. Mm-hmm. On the other side of it, you have a stock sale, which they are buying the company and everything that goes with that. The liability, the risk, the branding, the goodwill, everything is going with that. entity. And so there's a lot that can be leveraged through that, especially if there's a lot of goodwill and brand identity within the community they're operating. There's more tax advantages to a seller in that standpoint, but there's more risk on the buyer side. And so there may be some compression on that. I'll say even in our company, it was a stock sale, and there were some liability issues that they were concerned about, that they held money back in escrow to make sure that there weren't any issues that popped up afterwards, because they would be at risk for that.
Yep. And I know that C-Corps are a bit of a way of the dinosaur, but obviously if you're a C-Corp, it might make sense for you to do a stock sale because of the QSBS, correct?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of nuances to the tax law that changes every year. And every year we're going through this, it changes over to a new calendar year. Even if you're in the middle of this process, it could be advantageous to you, or it could ding you. And so just being aware and having somebody in your corner that understands what's going on in that realm is really important to be able to handle the structure of what's going on and be able to give you critical advice around that.
So if I can summarize this, the buyer wants to do an asset sale. The broker probably wants to do an asset sale because that's going to be a higher number that their percentage is off of, right? Maybe. So a lot of people are going to be incentivized to an asset sale. And most, are you seeing most sales are on the asset sale side?
No, I'm seeing them. The ones we're dealing with are mostly stock.
Okay.
And so, you know, you got your EBITDA that's playing into that. You got your multiple around that. You know, the asset sale is pretty black and white. You're buying the assets, right? So there's not a lot of opportunity to increase the value of that. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, depending on the type of company you are, depending on the industry you're in, you know, most of them are going to be stock sales. Yep. PEs like stock sales because they want the brand. They want to be able to run the business in the community they bought. They're not trying to take over operations. And so a stock sale is something that what we've seen, at least the ones we dealt with, they really kind of lean more towards that stock-based.
Great. And let's just, now we're talking about asset sale versus stock sale. Let's talk about a couple other terminologies here. Tell us about earnouts and rollover equity.
Yeah, interesting. So earnouts are the safety net for a buyer. So, Alan, if you're buying my company and I'm telling you we're going to hit 30% growth year over year with a compounded annual growth of, you know, 25% over the next 5 years, you know, and my books are not necessarily telling you that that's 100% because we haven't had a historical cadence of that, then what they're going to do is say, okay, they're going to negotiate what's called an earnout. And what they're saying is they're going to be specific performance benchmarks that your company needs to hit over the next 2, 3, 4 years. And each year you hit those, you're gonna get either the full earnout or a percentage of that earnout, whatever's negotiated. I read an article, I guess it was Q4 last year, that in 2025 and 2024, only 24% of earnouts were actually paid out.
Yeah.
And typically 70 to 80% is going to be cash on close, and the rest is going to be in an earnout, depending on what you're dealing with. And so earnouts are really kind of, you got to be careful. And once again, you got to have somebody who understands your business and can negotiate that for you. But if you have this information and data that backs everything up you're saying, then you shouldn't be worried about that.
If
you have an organization that can actually allow that growth to happen without you being there, you should feel even more comfortable with that you're going to receive it. Yeah. So that's an earnout.
How frustrating would that be to sell a company to another owner? You lose control. You no longer have, you no longer control your own destiny, but you're still expected to produce at a certain level here.
Absolutely.
It can get hairy quickly.
Yeah, and you need to understand what you're saying yes to, right? Because think about it. A buyer's going to obviously want things that are going to lean more towards their advantage. And if you're no longer in the day-to-day and they can really manipulate the numbers to be an advantage to them, you want to make sure that it's things that can't really be fudged. They can't increase expenses that lower your net profit margin without you having any, you know, say so around that, but you didn't hit your metrics because of that. Now all of a sudden your earnout has gone away because they didn't run the company appropriately. You know, things around gross revenue is good, you know, or certain benchmarks or certain areas that you're looking to grow the company. That's where you kind of want to stay, but you really need somebody who's going to go in there and negotiate on your behalf. Having a good attorney helps on that side of things, just to be able to look at the terms of what they're actually asking for.
Great. And let's talk about rollover equity. How often are you seeing rollover equity, and how can that be to the benefit of the owner?
Yeah, so we have one right now. It's an educational platform that a PE is looking at. There's incredible growth on the other side of once the PE would actually acquire them. Two owners are going to sell out. Two owners are kind of crucial to the success of that growth. And so they're probably going to either roll over 100% of what their portion is, or they'll take some and roll it back in. The beauty of it is that second bite of the apple, right? So you're getting the value of your company of where it is today. But the idea is that a private equity firm is going to come in and grow that company. They're going to inject a bunch of capital into it and leverage maybe some other portco holdings that they have to be able to give you opportunities that you would never be able to do on your own. And so if you roll that equity back into the company based on the value that you have there, then when they go and sell in, you know, let's say 5 to 7 years, there's a much bigger payday on that. Now, there's obviously a lot of risk. Do you take the money and run because you know what it is today and you're hoping it's going to be something else in the future, but it's not a guarantee, right? Things change and industries change. And so there is risk associated to that. But, you know, our advice is basically, look, if you can take what you got out of the company today and you can be financially secure, then maybe that's the best way to go. If you are going to make more than what you need to be financially secure, then take that amount and then roll it back over and let that be that second bite.
Great. And then one term that nobody, I've never met a business owner that was aware of this term until it's time, working capital, right? Let's talk about working capital. Every business owner thinks that the cash in their accounts is their cash. And then they get to the final finish line and all of a sudden, the buyer thinks that that's their cash. Tell us a little bit about working capital. How do you determine how much cash should be in there, and how is that negotiated?
Yeah, so the technical term is a net working capital peg that they are working on through due diligence to try to understand exactly what is needed. Once again, that is negotiable, right? And so it goes back to the books and making sure that you understand what your working capital needs actually are month to month. And a lot of that has to do with what are your terms on receivables? How current are you on your receivables? What is your cost of goods going out? What is your SG&A cost? All these things play into that. And so basically what you're trying to do, at least from a buyer's perspective, is making sure that we don't buy this company and then immediately have to inject capital in it just to keep the doors open, yep, right? Because that's not good business for anybody. So yes, that is negotiated and that does come off the top, right? A lot of times they'll hold it in escrow or at least a percentage of it to see if that's actually accurate or not. And so they'll have that target, and if it's over, they will refund you. And if it's under, then they will keep it, right? So there's a percentage that they keep in escrow to kind of CYA, just to make sure that they are covered on their end. And that's something that is negotiated to ensure that the buyers are not going to have to come out of pocket again, just to kind of keep the lights on.
Great. One last question on the finances. When we talk about financial cleanup, right, we're going back oftentimes looking at books, but what are some moves that can maybe make a business look stronger, maybe even reduce some of the tax and the transaction cost of selling a business?
Yeah, I mean, there's you can do like leasehold companies. If you have a huge fleet, you can actually have a leasehold company that owns all the vehicles and they're charging it back to the portfolio company. And, you know, those are things that you can kind of, you have the depreciation on the leasehold company. There's a lot of different things that you can do when you actually have assets and that you can kind of leverage that. We had a really interesting one in our company where we did not own the manufacturing of our product. We were 100% sales. But the manufacturer that we had this relationship with shut the doors down after about 65 years of being in business. And so it was a really interesting opportunity for us. And when we looked at it, we were kind of frazzled because every place we looked needed about $1 million worth of back stock. Well, we were able to get that through the EIDL loan. So it was good timing on that. And the government was giving very favorable rates around that money. And so we leveraged it and we turned that into our back stock kind of nest egg. And when we did that, Alan, it doubled our EBITDA. In the first year, it doubled our EBITDA and it put us into a completely different tranche of tiers. And so we were able to look at that and say, okay, this was a legacy relationship that we had run our business off of for nearly 80 years. And once it was forced upon us that we needed to make a decision, it actually created an incredible value add to our business and allowed us to sell for really a multiple that we didn't think was available to us at that time. And I think it goes back to just looking at your company from a strategic standpoint and saying, where are the opportunities? Thinking outside the box, having outside advice, having people looking at it and giving you, you know, some thought-provoking ideas, because you know, you can't read the label from inside the box, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, yeah. It's too close to that, too much subjectivity. You're stuck in your ways a lot of times. And so when you're forced to make a decision, a lot of times those decisions actually can be very advantageous if you put enough thought and time into it.
And once again, being exit ready does not have to happen the month before the sale here. It can happen at any time. And as a matter of fact, I think a lot of people would argue that business owners need to be exit ready yesterday, right? What if they had not woken up this morning? They still have to have the transition plan, the succession plan, right? All this stuff from operational efficiencies to financial due diligence needs to be done. So exit planning, in my opinion, is just good business planning with a deadline here on that. And there's no reason that businesses can't do that today. Now, let's do talk about one thing that business owners are going to push back on, right? And that is running their lifestyle through the business because they love that tax deduction, right? And that's right. One that you might be able to say, well, you know, in a couple of years prior, I'll start maybe keeping cleaner books. But how do you coach business owners to separate their business cash flow from their personal lifestyle spending so that the EBITDA is credible, clean, and is not going to get ripped apart during the due diligence phase?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's adjustments that you can make and some add backs that you can make for some of these kind of one-off expenses, but it's easier to run your books in a clean way that's showing profit. I mean, think about the companies we invest in, right? I mean, if they don't have clean books, transparent books, the price of their stock goes down, right? And it's the same thing with us. You're trying to save 20-25% of every dollar instead of creating a 3-5x on that dollar that you're showing at the bottom line.
Yeah.
So that $10 lunch that you went out and had could have been worth $50, $60 of added value. That didn't sound like a lot, but you apply that to every meal that you have every year.
Yeah.
You apply that to the car that has absolutely nothing to do with your business. You apply the vacations that you put into travel. You apply concert tickets for advertising and marketing, whatever it is that you're doing. Great, you didn't pay for it out of pocket. You saved yourself a little money on taxes, but you just dinged yourself tremendously in regards to when you actually try to go sell your company. And so I always ask, would you rather save 20-25% of a dollar or make 5-7x on that dollar? And I just don't think business owners are thinking about it because most CPAs, I'm not going to put them all in this box, but most CPAs are tax mitigators. Mm-hmm. That's what they're hired to do. And I'm not about paying more than you need to pay, but profit is a direct link to your value of your company. Yeah. Taxes are a byproduct of that profit. So you just, I get it, play the game that you want to play, but understand that at some point you're going to have to pay the piper, right? And you know, at this point, the value is so much higher on the back end.
Yeah.
And if we can at least show them that, right, on paper of what they're losing. We're dealing one right now. There's about $120,000 that we're going to have to adjust out on the EBITDA. The problem is that buyers are getting really hesitant on taking face value the adjustments and add backs that, mm-hmm. that a seller is showing. And so they're going to do their own. Once again, they're running their own Q of E. So they're going to go in and they're going to look at every single thing and they're going to come back with their adjusted EBITDA. And guess what? It's not going to be as nice as yours.
Yep.
So, you know, the point is that playing the game that, you know, by the rules that you have in front of you is one thing, but understanding the long-term impact of that is really just kind of shooting yourself in the foot. And one last thing, you said it earlier, Alan, is that, you know, being transaction ready. None of my clients that have this 5 to 7 year timeline actually sell within that 5 to 7 years. They yeah. always sell before. Mm. And the reason is that we put their company in a position where they're attractive to a buyer. Mm. And so they're getting offers. And so, you know, if somebody comes in 2-3 years before you're ready to sell and it's an incredible offer and we know your company's ready to go, why would you not do it, right? You can't guarantee in 3 or 4 years that your company's gonna be in that same situation. That's and right. so being transaction ready is really, really important.
Well, markets change, interest rates change, absolutely. Right? Your business change, risks change, right? So fantastic everything. Stuff. Yep. Well, hey, coming up in our final segment, I'm gonna ask Bennett how to keep deals from turning into chaos at the finish line and what owners should do so the transition feels smooth for employees, customers, and their families. I'm Alan Franks, host of Frankly Speaking, only on Now Media Television. We're here with one goal and one goal only. Our aim is to solve any business owner problem, anywhere, anytime. Join me for my next episode of Frankly Speaking, only on Now Media Television. If you want more episodes like this, you can watch Now Media TV live or on demand. Download the app on Roku or iOS and listen to the podcast anytime at nowmedia.tv. Welcome back to our final segment of Frankly Speaking. I'm here with Bennett Leibowitz. We've talked readiness, pre-diligence, and tax reality. Now let's talk about execution, because the last mile is where deals get emotional. Founders get protective, buyers get cautious, and everyone starts negotiating from physical exhaustion, mental and emotional exhaustion, and fear. So Bennett, walk me through this chaos zone between the LOI and the close here.
Yeah, so, you know, everybody gets really excited about the LOI. And what we tell our clients is that this is about as good as it's gonna get, right? and now the discounting is where it starts, really the rubber meets the road on this. And so the work that you've done pre-LOI is going to pay dividends on due diligence. And so if you can shorten the due diligence period, typically it can take anywhere between 6 and 7 months. I've seen them go longer. I've seen them go shorter. Mm. But if you can compress that, what that means to a buyer is that you've answered all of their questions, right? And so the LOI value stays true because they haven't really been able to find anything to discount it. So if you just take your business and decide to go to market and yes, you get an LOI, there is no guarantee from that standpoint. Mm-hmm. The other thing to understand is most LOIs are non-binding, which means anybody can walk away at any time. And so the fact that you have an LOI is exciting. The fact that you have a value that you're willing to sign for that LOI is exciting, but none of the work has taken place yet. And so the exhaustion, the emotional roller coaster that you're on during due diligence is just about to get started. Yep. And you have to be mentally prepared for that process. So typically, you know, Alan, we are building out that virtual data room. That is a tremendous time saver because we hand that over to a buyer's team and they literally have pretty much 80% of what they need right out of the gate. Mm-hmm. And so now when they're asking for things, they're asking for one-off documents that are specific to their own process, not necessarily the entirety of that due diligence checklist, which can be almost 100 plus items long in terms of documents that they're going to request. That means you need to talk to attorneys. That means you need to talk to bankers. That means you need to talk to CPAs, wealth managers, insurance brokers, all these people, because you don't have a single place where all of that document is stored. And that is a time cruncher right there, in the sense that you're spending all of this time that you need to be actually running your business. You're spending it trying to get this information to a buyer's group. And oh yeah, by the way, most of the people that can get that for you, you haven't even told that you're going to market.
Yep. So let's talk about that real quick, right? So how does the owner help protect that culture and that continuity during this transition? Because we hear about all the time where business owners go to sell and their revenue drops and people aren't as focused because it is a full-time job to sell it. So how do you coach owners through protecting the business, the culture, and the people that are there?
Well, I mean, we're part of their advisory team, right? So we're answering a lot of those questions. We're handling a lot of the conversations with the buyer's group, their IB that they're dealing with, that they hired to help represent them. So we do a lot of that lifting, and we know the company pretty intimately, where we have a really good idea of where the gaps are. So we come with that on the front end and say, hey, here's what we have, but here's what you're probably going to find. And because we bring it to the buyer instead of the buyer bringing it to us, we kind of save a lot of pain in terms of just them going down that rabbit hole. But also, it may not be as big of a deal because we brought it to them, and it shows that we're being transparent throughout the process. Mm-hmm. So we try to remove as much of that heavy lift on the owner's plate. We try to take that on. And we do that up to the point where they actually have to make a decision. So they can go run the business. They can do the things that they need to do. But the real opportunity is having your team run the day-to-day, because you don't do that anymore, right? Because we've removed that owner reliance, and you have a team, a middle management group that is really running the business, and things are moving as they always did before the sale. And so you should be able to have some bandwidth to deal with this. The problems come when you don't have the bandwidth, because you're dealing with all the tactical things that are going on in your business. You don't have a team that you can really rely on or trust to get the job done. And so you're isolating yourself even more than you already were. Yep. And at that point, there's no amount of support that we can give you that's really going to take that headache off your plate.
Yep. Well, let's talk a little bit too about what happens after the LOI. I always feel like after that LOI gets there, the leverage shifts a bit, right? The leverage is in the owners, because they're going out to market. They're getting a lot of bids, people putting their best foot forward. And then they choose an LOI to focus in on. And I feel like the leverage shifts over to the buyer at that moment in time. They're going to get all the information from the business, and then they're just going to scrutinize it here. So what's your playbook for to prevent this retrading here at the end? And out of curiosity, have you ever seen a deal where the LOI and the actual deal were the exact same thing, or are they pretty much different 100% of the time?
No, I mean, the clients that we've represented for a while, absolutely. We have seen that being true, because we give so much supporting evidence before the LOI even comes. One of the things that a step that's missed is the IOI, so that indication of interest, where you have hopefully a pool of buyers that are coming in and courting you, so to speak, to be able to say, hey, I think you should go with us. And interesting, I keep going back to our family company, because I think it's just an interesting case study. We had a $16 million delta between the lowest bid and the highest bid. $16 million. And the reality was that we showed all the same information to all of those buyers. The situation was that the person who did the lower bid, they couldn't extract as much value as those that had a higher bid. And so we were able to kind of look at not only who had a better offer, but who could actually take our objectives of creating that next stage of the legacy and really being able to fulfill that. And I think that's something that's not really talked about. If you have one buyer and one LOI, that's what you got, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
to not have options, to not create a bidding war, because the buyer that we sold to was not the highest bidder.
Yep.
They were actually the second highest, but they brought their bid up because they wanted the company so badly that they brought their bid up to the highest bidder. And yes, we sold for 100% of what that LOI value was.
Fantastic. Hey, so why do most businesses not sell? I know we talked about some statistics that are pretty alarming last time, 25%, only 25% sell. I'd be curious, Bennett, out of the companies that you represent, what percentage of those go from LOI to sell, right? But in your experience, obviously it could be a lot of things, but what are you finding why most businesses don't sell?
Yeah, I think if you're talking generically, Alan, I would say there's a lot of, you know, you got biz buy sell, you have a lot of business brokers that it's a numbers game, right? And so they're competing against a lot of other brokers. And so they're willing to take you to market, but they're not really doing their pre-diligence to even see if it's a ready to go to market mm-hmm. company. And so part of the problem is that you have a lot of people saying that your company is sellable. To get the business, and they're willing to throw it out there and seeing if they can find some buyers, because that's their model, right? They're transactionary, and so that's what they're doing. The ones that are actually taking the time to build their company and place it in the market from a position of strength, they have a much higher success rate. We're about 90% of the companies that we're representing. Obviously, we haven't sold all the companies that we're still representing, but the ones that we've taken to market, they've sold pretty much every time. The ones that have not, it was a couple of them were the buyers. Mm-hmm. Things changed internally within what they were trying to look at. And then we had a couple that walked away because they were enjoying what they were doing. They were seeing the true growth opportunity, and they felt like they were leaving money on the table. Even yep. though they were ready to sell, they felt like, you know, due diligence kind of gave them a really good idea of really what yeah. we were preparing them for. And so they said, hey, give it another 2 years. We think there's more growth on the table.
Yeah.
And they're going to come back around. And that's all right, right? I mean, just because you're in due diligence doesn't mean you have to carry through that process. Once again, the LOI is non-binding, so anybody yep. can walk away.
And that is the leverage that the business owner has, is that you don't have yes. to sell to anybody. You can always take it back out, put it to market, or realize what they're knocking you for, take a couple of years, go fix it, and then come back to the deal here.
Well, not even fix it, just leverage the growth that you've created, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that, you know, it's like, I'm not going to do all the heavy lifting just for the buyer to take the growth that we've created and you know, we don't get paid for it. So right. there's a lot of reasons why somebody would walk away at the last minute. We just want to make sure that it's not because you have cold feet or because you don't have an understanding of what your next chapter is going to look like.
Totally.
You're going to regret that. So,
well, let's talk about that for the last question here, actually, is we talked yeah. about seller's remorse. Okay. And only 25% of sellers are happy a year later here. I personally believe that business owners, being a business owner is a very honorable thing. And people wear that as a badge of pride. And the day after sure. they sell that business, they no longer have that badge of pride. They're just like everybody else in this world, right? When do you start sensing that might be an issue? There's a lot of work here that you've got to do. So a seller getting cold feet is not good, right? When do you start sensing that's an issue? How do you make certain it's not going to be a total deal breaker? And what are you doing to maybe coach the sellers here a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, look, we have this kind of 3-month, 90-day process that we're really trying to understand the company. And obviously, as we're doing that, we're really starting to get to know the owners. And, you know, the challenge is when you have multiple owners versus just one owner. Another challenge is when you have married owners or siblings or, you know, father, son, mother, daughter, whatever it is. Those relationships also create unique aspects to what we're trying to accomplish. And in that situation where you're having multiple owners, you're asking them, like, what is their objective from the sale? What are they, you know, are they planning to really retire? They have a passion around something or whatever it is. I mean, we're having that from a conversational level. And in our findings, what we'll do when we come back is we say, hey, we really see this as something that could kind of rear its ugly head at the last minute and derail a lot of what we're working on. We have people that we would bring in to help navigate that conversation. That's not what we do. But we do highlight it and bring it to the attention that this is a real issue, yep. right? And that what we're trying to accomplish for them is for all of their objectives to be fulfilled, right? And not just the sale, right? Yep. I don't want to sell something and then you call me up or I see you 6 months down the road and you're not in a good way from a health perspective or whatever because you just kind of went off the rails, right? Because you just had your identity was almost stolen from you. And to what you were saying, you were known in the community as the business owner. And I've seen it so many times. I've seen it with my own family. It's a real issue. And so, you know, we try to identify that really early on, Alan, in our process. And then hopefully we have enough time to where we can bring somebody in to really help have that conversation with them.
Great. So Bennett, where should people follow you and Pando Consulting Group? And what's the best first step if an owner wants to know how sellable their business really is?
Yeah, so like I said, pandoconsultinggroup.com is our website. There's a ton of information on there. We have some white papers, some case studies, a couple other podcasts that you can kind of go on and get, you know, some education around that. But I think the biggest thing is we just want to have a conversation. We are not here to work with everybody, but we are here to have as many conversations as we can with people to help educate them. And like I said earlier, if you want to do something about it, then we would be more than happy to help facilitate that. But at the end of the day, even if we had you just kind of take a step back and reevaluate how you would go to market and how you would sell your business and really have an honest opinion about where some of the gaps exist, I think our job is done, right? I mean, it's that's all we can do at a surface level. It takes a lot of work to get your company ready, and we're not trying to diminish that. But the ones that do it are going to reap the rewards of it afterwards.
Bennett, thank you so much for your time here today and helping us understand that a sellable business, it's a system. It's not just a person or a personality, and pre-diligence is not busy work. It's leverage. And the smartest exits aren't just about price. They're about that after-tax reality, both financially and emotionally and mentally as well. To everyone watching, start with your lifestyle goals. Reverse engineer that business so make certain that the sell and the funds help support that lifestyle. Whether you sell your business in 12 months or in 5 years, that's how you build wealth. And don't try to do this alone here. Call on people that can help you. Call on people like Bennett that can help you get to that finish line successfully. My name's Alan Franks, and this is Frankly Speaking. I'll see you next time.